From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on this Cesar Chavez Day, communities around the state are remembering the legendary farm labor organizer. But a report out today shows that while much has changed for farm workers, they still experience some of the toughest working conditions in the nation. The report cites low wages, weak labor protections for children and youth, exploitation by unscrupulous farm labor contractors, and poor housing as just some of the issues farm workers still face. But, as you might imagine, not everyone agrees with those findings. We'll discuss the report and the legacy of Cesar Chavez this hour on Forum, and we'll get started right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Well, today is Cesar Chavez Day, and throughout California, communities are marking the labor leader's birth 84 years ago. Chavez fought to unionize farm workers and improve their working conditions with protests and strikes that won new rights but also generated lasting animosity from agricultural groups along the way. Well, a new report out today, co-sponsored by the United Farm Workers Union, indicates that despite progress over the past few decades, people working in the fields still often face harsh and sometimes harsh conditions and sometimes exploitation. And so on this Cesar Chavez Day, we're going to examine the state of farm workers in 2011. And we're going to begin with two folks representing the groups that co-authored this report. Eric Nicholson is National Vice President for the United Farm Workers. Good morning to you.
Morning.
And also with us, Maisie Greenwalt. She's vice president for the Bon Appetit Management Company. They're a food service company based in Palo Alto. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
Let me begin with you, Eric Nicholson. Why now, and how did you go about putting this report together?
Well, why now came a result of conversations we've been having with Bon Appetit and other retailers, food service providers, about what is the state of farm workers in terms of legal compliance. And our experience in the field had been one of kind of our signature line has been the laws in the fields are not the, or the laws in the books are not the laws in the fields. But understanding we need to get past that and really document and objectively as possible what is the status of farm workers. So we were proud to partner with Bon Appetit to really look across sectors. What does this mean? We looked at 11 different areas in our report and documented what are the protections that are provided, what are the exclusions, and to the degree we're able to obtain the information, what were the rates of inspection to actually ensure that the laws on the books were being enforced.
And give us a sense, you don't have to name all 11, but what were some of those areas you looked at?
Health and safety, housing, wage and hour, guest worker, fatality rates, wages, child labor.
And you looked not just at California, correct?
We looked at the top six states in terms of farm worker populations. So that includes California, Washington, Oregon, Florida, Texas, and North Carolina.
And in terms of data, how hard was it to find it and to analyze it?
It was extremely difficult. There's a variety of sources, and there is a lot of data gaps out there. So it was very labor-intensive actually tracking down the sources, and then there's major gaps. So a great example is if you look at reported rates of injuries for workers in agriculture, dramatic underreporting. So we had to be able to acknowledge the holes that there are in the existing data to provide an accurate picture of what's actually happening in the field.
And how do you know it's underreported?
Well, when you talk to workers and you talk to advocates, one of the things that we looked at was the atmosphere of threats, of intimidation that workers have reported in terms of complaining from anywhere of a workplace injury to a lack of toilet paper in the bathrooms.
And because there are six states here, I wondered the extent to which you have a sense of, you know, how does California rate or rank compared to those other five big states?
I think it's fair to say that California has better laws on the books. California has overtime payment for workers. Most states in the country do not include overtime pay for agricultural workers. California is one of the first states to implement heat stress regulations. Unfortunately, the implementation and inspection of those regulations have fallen way short, and we continue to have workers who are dying in the field because of failure to be able to access drinking water and shade.
And thinking mostly about California, but if you want to bring in the other states, that's fine. What are some of the, you mentioned a couple of them, but what are some of the other, most egregious or maybe most common problems that you found?
Well, I think there's some fundamental issues, is that the way we've structured agricultural work in this country is simply not sustainable for the people that are picking our crops. So the report documents that more than half of farm workers earn less than $20,000 a year. These aren't lazy people. These are folks that are struggling to survive. Most are year-round residents, have families, and are proud of the work they do, but at $20,000 or less, it's very difficult to support your family, much less advance in society. We've got a fatality rate that's five times higher than non-agricultural work. So workers, as I mentioned, are dying in agriculture to put food on our tables, and we've got a higher workplace injury rate. So just those three indicators suggest we've got some serious problems. And really, I think the intent of the report is not necessarily cast aspersions, but to say, look, we have an objective problem in the industry. And I think one of our intent of partnering with Bon Appetit is to say, we all have a responsibility here. How do we work collaboratively to identify solutions that meet everyone's needs so farmers can have a sustainable livelihood, food service providers, retailers can have a quality product at a fair price that they can sell to their customers, and growers can prosper. We definitely want growers to continue to expand, to produce here in the United States, but it has to be predicated on fairness to workers.
All right, well, let's bring your other partner in on this project, Maisie Greenewalt from Bon Appetit Management Company. What's a management, a food management company doing involved in a report like this?
As a food management company that has long looked at our supply chain for things like local purchasing, antibiotics use in animal husbandry, sustainable seafood, we came to a point where we could no longer ignore the part of our supply chain that's human. And there wasn't enough data out there. We knew that there were egregious things going on, and we needed to help the advocacy community compile that data in a way that others could use.
And your company does food in places like, well, give us a sense of your clients, but I know you do work, for example, at Oracle and other Silicon Valley companies.
We serve corporations, private colleges and universities, and museums in 31 states. We're at Oracle, as you mentioned, Yahoo, Cisco, eBay, University of Pennsylvania, Duke University, Art Institute of Chicago.
And any sense of how your clients feel about your getting involved in something that's, you know, could be controversial?
Our clients have been really receptive to having their eyes open to the issue. 2 years ago, we had the chance to go to Immokalee, Florida, and meet with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Florida has been called ground zero for slavery in the United States today. There have been 7 prosecuted cases of slavery in Florida. And as we came back and told that story to our clients, they were blown away. People don't know these things are going on, and when they hear about it, they're very happy to do something about it.
Do you agree with what Eric Nicholson just said, that you know, when you look at these 6 states, California may be, you know, ahead of the pack in terms of at least the laws on the books?
Absolutely. I was speaking to a grower who operates in both Florida and California, and he said any grower that operates in California has to have a stronger HR infrastructure to deal with the laws than operating in any other state, and that affords some protections to the workers.
And so I know this report is just out today. Everyone's going to begin digesting it, so to speak. But what do you hope to get from it, and how might it change the way you go about doing your business?
When we came back from Florida and started talking to large produce producers around the country, we heard over and over again, we follow the laws, we're in legal compliance, and there really isn't a problem anymore. This report was designed to say, first of all, the laws aren't sufficient, and the laws aren't being followed. So let's just set the baseline of things aren't okay. Now let's work together to come up with a solution.
So your goal is to make things better as opposed to boycotting certain companies? Or like, how are you going to make things better?
We hope that we can work collaboratively, that we can work along the supply chain, meaning everyone from the farm worker advocacy groups like the United Farm Workers to the growers to the distributors who play a major role but are often unseen to a purchaser like Bon Appetit Management Company, and that together, by opening our eyes to the issue, that we can come up with a solution.
Well, let's bring in another voice here. Juan Santiago is president of the Central Valley Youth Association, a former farm worker, and I know the Youth Association, Mr. Santiago, works on farm labor conditions. What are your thoughts about what you've heard so far this hour?
Yes, I kind of agree with Mr. Nicholson. Like he said, you know, we have the laws in, we have, I think in California, we have the best laws in terms of farm workers in the, but it actually is not implementing in the fields. I myself, I'm a farm worker. Last year, I spent my summer picking blueberries by the Stockton area. And one thing that I noticed, you know, there wasn't the necessary shape for the farm workers where we get the triple digit. They bring it, but that's not until when they actually needed to. And the water is supposed to be there when the farm workers start working, but they don't do that. They bring water until 11 or sometime until noontime. So that was my experience, farm worker.
And so you still do farm work in addition to working with the Youth Association?
Well, I'm a student, but usually in summer, I spend my summer working in the farm with my family, yes.
And what do you hear from farm workers and their families? Do they say, like, what are they asking for? In addition to some of the specifics you just mentioned, that, you know, they'd like to see water in the fields more earlier in the day. But what else in terms of oversight, regulation, law?
I think what farm worker is asking is actually justice in the field. Because what we just noticed, you know, with the death of Maria Isabel in 2008, this is the young lady was died because the foreman and the supervisor was not prepared, was not trained to actually to face a situation like this. And what we notice now that the judge in the Stockton area decided not to punish those who were responsible because of her death, but actually giving them like 40 community hours and probation. So the farm workers are asking justice in the fields.
And that young woman you referred to, that was a 17-year-old worker who was pregnant in, I believe it was in Stockton, two, three years ago, right?
Right, 2008.
Yeah. Well, let me bring in Barry Bedwell. He's president of the California Grape and Tree Fruit League. Mr. Bedwell, good to have you with us this morning.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you.
What you've been listening as well. What's your perspective as a grower and from an organization that represents growers on what you've heard?
Well, you know, what I've heard, I certainly have some points of agreement. I also have some points that I don't think are accurate. I think clearly, and we work in California exclusively with our membership, and I certainly agree with the comments about California being at the forefront in terms of all of these laws to assure worker safety, protection, wage, and hour. I would like to point out, though, that some of the information may be a little bit dated. And a good example of, I think, how we respond to some of these new regulations is indicated by those very same heat stress and heat illness prevention regulations that we've been talking about. You know, the reality is that over the last 2 years, there have been no heat-related deaths in agriculture in California. And that's a record that we want to move forward with. To give you an example of that collaboration as well and cooperation, we just finished a seminar a couple of days ago, again, training both in Spanish and English about the regulations in conjunction with the industry and Cal OSHA. We think that was very successful. We think the awareness and education is paramount in preventing heat illness. And we want to move forward to make sure that all of these folks, the farmers as well as the farm employees, get the respect and dignity they deserve in providing the food for this nation. So, you know, in terms of some of the things that may be happening in other states, we are always about making sure that compliance is the goal. And we think the regulations are there. We think the compliance numbers are getting better. We think they're excellent in most cases. But we do want to work together in a collaborative fashion, as indicated, and we think we are making great strides.
To what extent do you think that the lack of compliance is willful from a group of, if you'll pardon the expression, bad apples or maybe labor subcontractors versus, you know, just sort of an industry-wide, I don't know what the word would be, not a lack of interest, but, you know, perhaps just they know that the enforcement won't be there, so maybe it gets a little bit lax from time to time.
Well, I tend to think that our enforcement is very good in California. And to give you an example, when you talk about employment for 16 or 17-year-olds, we go through a system where those work sites have to be pre-approved. They are monitored while that work is going on. And then there is a post-work examination. I do think, you know, within any case, there can be bad actors. None of us. There is no excuse for noncompliance. None of us should try to ever hide or you know, defend the bad actor. We think that that is a minority. We think that we need to get to those people, educate them. In terms of willful, not complying willfully, I find that very rare, if ever. And in my many years of experience, I think farmers and growers know that they want to do the right thing by their employees. They need to work as a team in a very difficult and competitive world environment. So I think the attitudes generally are very good. If someone is not doing it, we should all be concerned and we should all follow up to make sure they comply accordingly.
Maisie Greenewald, what's your take on what you're hearing from Mr. Bedwell? Do you have a sense that it is just a few bad actors in a very large sector of the economy?
I think there's definitely a spectrum, but I was at a large multi-state producer about 2 years ago walking the field, invited by that producer onto the farm, so I expect it was one of their best operations. And all of the laborers that I saw were contractors being managed by a farm labor contractor. National records show that 67% of farm labor contracted employees don't speak English. And the farm manager, the one employee of the actual grower on the farm, had been working on that farm for over 15 years and said he didn't speak any Spanish. I consider that to be willful. If you've been working with an entirely Spanish-speaking crew for over 15 years and you don't speak Spanish, I think that you are willfully trying to ignore how that crew is being managed.
And did you point that out to them? And what did you say?
I did. And they sort of smile and give a, aw, shucks, kind of kick the ground response.
Let me bring Don Villarejo in now. He's the founder and director emeritus of the California Institute for Rural Studies. I know you've looked at these kinds of issues for many, many years, decades really. What is your take on just what the situation is today versus how it was a few decades ago and how it could be better?
I think there is evidence that there have been improvements. I think that the report that is called the Inventory of Farm Worker Issues and Protections that was just issued today on Cesar Chavez's anniversary of his birth and a holiday for state workers in California is a useful report. It does highlight shortcomings in our treatment of farm workers in the United States, and I think that's a valuable contribution. I think the general key points that are raised in the executive summary are basically correct, and that is, I think it's undeniable that U.S. farm workers have fewer legal protections compared to other workers in other sectors of United States industry and commerce. There's no question of that. Starting with the National Labor Relations Act, 1935, that provided for the first time federal protections for workers to engage in concerted action on their own behalf to improve wages and working conditions, agricultural workers and domestic workers were excluded. And that was the model for the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. So that point is absolutely clear. There's no question in my mind there are also abuses occurring today as well. But I think it's fair to say that in California, and Barry Bedwell has emphasized this as well, and I think it was admitted by Eric and Maisie, that is, conditions are much better here. And a really good example of that, I think, comes with respect to the injury and fatality rates that we're discussing. And Eric's comment is correct. It's five times more common in agriculture to have an occupational fatality than in other industries combined. So when you look at the information we have available, you find that the OSHA regulation set at the national standard exempts most small farms. It's about 90% of U.S. farms are exempt from OSHA regulation, and there are specific reasons why that occurred, but nevertheless, that's the rule. But in California, we don't exempt small farms from regulation. And very recently, in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine, Somerville and Conway published a report examining how the fatality rate in California, actually Oregon and Washington, that don't have the small farm exemption from OSHA regulation, how the fatality rate compares with other farm states. And the fatality rate in California is less than half of what it is in states where false farms are exempted. So that's an example of the power of enforcement. I think enforcement could be very much better. I felt that we did a very poor job in the early years of the heat illness regulation. I hope it's going to improve, but nevertheless, there's litigation right now in state court against Cal OSHA for inadequate compliance, that is inadequate enforcement. So I think there is room for improvement, and I'd like to see that case come to trial and actually get the court to hear what's going on. I should also comment that I've only looked very briefly at a portion of the report. I just got a copy of it yesterday evening. And there are some, I feel, very invaluable contributions on the one hand, but also some shortcomings. So, for example, one table talks about the number of OSHA inspections on crop farms in California. 477 is what the report says. But the report didn't look at enforcement of labor contractor employees. That is to say, conditions on farms where labor contractors were working. And there were an additional 566 inspections in the same year on labor contractor-operated businesses. And so you have, instead of 477, over 1,000 inspections. So that's an example of, I feel, just a shortcoming. It's not intentional on the part of the authors of the report. They just simply didn't think very carefully or thoroughly about where they need to look. And enforcement is improving, and we still have a ways to go, as I indicated, with respect to, for example, the heat illness regulation. But nevertheless, I think we are making progress, and we need to acknowledge that.
One of the issues in California and throughout the country is that most farm workers are not unionized. Some people feel that's important, others don't. But I want to point out that as we speak, Senate Bill 104, sponsored by Senator Daryl Steinberg, is being debated in the legislature up in Sacramento this hour, and that would make it easier for farm workers to organize, to unionize. Barry Bedwell, from your perspective, what difference would that make, for better and worse?
Well, SB 104 is the latest edition of what we certainly see as card check, and really an infringement on the rights of the farm employees themselves. The reality is, when you talk about the characterization that this is somehow an alternative means to select a union, no one has really stated how that would work, that if you had over 50% of the cards checked, how you would ever get to the secret ballot. And what this really comes down to, I think, are some people that feel that the farm employees will be better off unionized, and they're going to create a situation in which they could be unionized. We're very concerned that this really is an issue of letting the farm employee decide for themselves on the value of joining an organized labor group. The reality is, many of the improvements that have been made over the last decades in terms of worker health and safety, wage and hour, and so forth, have been done through the legislature. And a lot of that has been done in conjunction with the United Farm Workers. It is very difficult now to go to the farm employee and say, what are you going to get for your dues, whether that's 2 or 3% or whatever the number is. So we're very concerned that the issue that was brought up for the rationale for this is saying that there somehow lacks balance, okay, and the employer has too much influence.
Okay, we're going to. I'm sorry to cut you off. We have to take a short break, and we'll come back to you after the break. But we'd love to hear from you. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. And on this Cesar Chavez Day, we're talking about a new report out by the United Farm Workers and a Palo Alto-based food service company, Bon Appetit Management, looking at the health and safety protections for U.S. farm workers here in California and across the country. If you would like to join us, give us a call, 866-733-6786. The number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts, comments, questions to forum@kqed.org. bonappetit.org. Joining us this hour, Maisie Greenewalch. She is vice president for Bon Appetit. Also with us, Barry Bedwell, president of the California Grape and Tree Fruit League, Don Villarejo from the California Institute for Rural Studies, and Eric Nicholson from the United Farm Workers. And Barry Bedwell, just before the break, I cut you off. I apologize. You were talking about union protections, SB 104, the bill being debated this hour in the state legislature, and whether or not it's really necessary. Anything you want to say there before I move on?
Sure. Thank you, Scott. The reality we all need to understand is that California is unique in that it has the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act, which governs the farm employees' rights to join a collective bargaining unit. The concern here expressed and the purpose for this bill by the proponents is saying that employers have the power of intimidation. What we really need to be discussing, if under the law's unfair labor practice provisions, if they are not adequate and they are allowing intimidation, whether it be on the part of the employer or the union, we need to address that. I don't think we solved the problem by taking away the farm employees' right to a secret ballot and therefore swinging the pendulum to the point where the union clearly can have an opportunity to intimidate or misinform. And this is, I think, an area that we really need to step back, take a look at, and decide what's best for the farm employee and not necessarily organized labor.
All right. I want to bring Manuel Cunha in a moment from the Nisei Farmers League. But Eric Nicholson from the UFW, quick comment. I imagine you have a different perspective on SB 104.
Oh, absolutely. As an organization that works directly with and for farm workers, this is something that farm workers themselves have designated as a top priority. And I think one of the ongoing frustrations of the hundreds, if not thousands, of workers with whom I've come into contact in my career has been the repeated and concerted campaigns by agriculture employers to threaten, intimidate, and fire workers in an effort to keep them from exercising their true right to have union representation. So the bill that's currently before the Assembly is the result of farm workers, a bill that farm workers strongly support that's been passed before, vetoed by the prior governor, and something that we believe would facilitate workers being able to have the power to address many of the shortcomings that we highlight in the inventory.
Well, let me bring in Manuel Cunha from the Nisei Farmers League. Mr. Cunha, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Scott. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Don't want to talk for the whole rest of the hour about SB 104, but I do want to get your perspective on this notion of making it easier or changing the way that farm laborers do or do not join a union. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think I go back to what this organization was founded on with Cesar Chavez and Harry Kuvel, the president. Many of those was the rights of workers, and Cesar Chavez, in a document that I have even in my office back then, which we got a portfolio that's probably a full file cabinet of articles and statements, said by Cesar Chavez that the workers have a right to a private ballot, you know, to that confidentiality. That's very important. And Eric definitely said he has spoken to thousands of farm workers. Well, I actually am one of those ag leaders, just like Mr. Bidwell. We walk in the fields, and I walk in the fields because of another issue, and it's called immigration, just like Arturo Rodriguez talks about immigration. I've been in the fields, and many farm workers feel that their rights and what the employer is doing is good. Everything is the worker doesn't feel intimidated. He's not discriminated. So one can say it on the other hand as well, but I've actually been in the field, and in might of fact, when this went before Arnold Schwarzenegger a year and a half ago, we got actual signatures of over 20,000 single individuals, signed individual documents, and we carried them up to Sacramento. That was done by workers, not by me or anybody else. It was workers to workers. So I believe that and I support what Mr. Bidwell, of course, is saying, but being one of those ag groups that have been in the fields and what this organization was founded on with Harry Kuvel as the past president, along with Cesar Chavez, both men are dead. I think we've seen a tremendous amount of improvements in this state. And so that's the comment on that. I believe these workers have a right to a private a private ballot.
Don Villarejo from the California Institute for Rural Studies. Quick comment about SB 104, and then I want to move to immigration because that is sort of the elephant in the room here. What are your thoughts about the card check, secret ballot, SB 104, and then let's talk about immigration after that.
I'm uncomfortable with the proposal as it's written. I think that the issue is whether or not a worker has the right to initiate on their own behalf filling out a card and signing it. As I read the law, as it's proposed, the union would fill out the card and then simply ask the worker to sign it. I don't think that's wise. I also think we do need to protect the right of a secret ballot. And it's true, there's been intimidation, and there is a remedy for it through the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, which is an unusual body created to fill the gap where federal law through the National Labor Relations Act did not protect farm workers. And so we do have that institution here, and we do have the ability to protect workers. I think the bill could be improved, and I think clarification of the right of workers to initiate on their own behalf, either to support a union or to oppose a union, is something that should be protected, including the right of secret ballot.
And what about immigration? It is sort of underlying all of these issues in some, one way or another. What difference would it make if there were, say, comprehensive immigration reform for the what difference would it make to agricultural workers?
An enormous difference. Right now, people are fearful because of their immigration status. Or I should say lack of authorization to work in the United States. And that fear translates into reluctance to complain about conditions, reluctance to contact authorities to deal with infractions and violations of law they observe. It goes to access to health care. You have to remember, 75% of farm workers do not have any access to care through health insurance or government programs because primarily of poverty and lack of immigration status. I think turning around the immigration status is something that farmers strongly support, as well as workers. That is, my understanding is, with all of the farmers I've talked with, as well as labor contractors, they favor comprehensive immigration reform. They would like to see a legally authorized labor force, and that's something that the union agrees with as well. So this is a priority, I think, for the United States today. It doesn't affect only farm workers. It affects the millions of workers in other industries as well. We need to have comprehensive immigration reform.
We are talking about health and safety protections for U.S. farm workers here in California and across the country, and I'd like to ask our listeners to weigh in on the question. You know, we talk a lot about when we're eating out at restaurants or shopping about sustainability, and there's a lot of discussion about seafood, for example. But what about produce? What about agriculture? As a food consumer, how concerned are you about labor conditions, where the food you're buying, the produce you're buying, those conditions in the fields there? Let us know. 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to forum@kqed.org. Let's go now to Dave in Phoenix, Arizona. Dave, welcome.
Hi, thanks. I grew up in a small ag town, and I work in the finance industry now. I'm just wondering if the same things that happen in the mortgage finance industry structurally in terms of how workers were incentivized aren't also driving what's going on in the fields. I mean, brokers, realtors, all kinds of folks in the finance industry were being incentivized to meet their numbers and to fudge the numbers and do things that were patently illegal. And I think in the same way, the guys that are supervising the field workers might be doing the same thing. The growers really don't have a good sense of what's going on the ground. They're looking at the numbers. They're trying to sell their product, and they're incentivizing their supervisors to, get the product in. And I grew up, like I said, in a small ag town. A couple of my friends, their dads were field supervisors, and they're pretty nasty guys. The girls at school always aspired to marry the guy that was going to be the supervisor because they got paid the best, but they got paid because they really cracked the whip, and there was a very bad relationship between Mexicans who had achieved that status as a supervisor and the guys that were picking the crops. It was kind of internalized racism and then just bad management. And
yeah,
I think the owners of the field just don't get it.
Yeah, well, you raise a good point. Barry Bedwell, what about that notion of where is the incentive for supervisors and growers to really, be honest, come forward and fully report problems, violations, those kinds of things?
Well, you know, I think the situation, we have to look at this from an economic point of view as well, and not just in terms of is there incentives. Let's realize one thing here, that we are dealing with an industry that has to compete on a worldwide basis that many people characterize as being a low-income base. But in reality, the wages that are paid by agriculture, and in our normal harvest operations, we may see between $9 and $12 an hour. And for many of the listeners, that is clearly low wages. But keep in mind that those wages for an individual or family in our neighboring countries to the South, that is a chance for a better life, a better opportunity. So the natural economic process provides incentive. Within that structure, in terms of the supervisorial situation, I have to say, I think it would be very difficult to make any kind of general statements like that. We have seen certainly situations where we've had very good farm labor contractors for the most part, as well as supervisors. But if they aren't, I have also seen situations where the grower understands that, takes it into consideration, and will make changes. But I think just to make general statements is not accurate in this case.
Don Villarejo, anything to add to that in terms of that relationship between growers and supervisors, or supervisors and farm workers?
Yes, the supervisor, the mayordomo, is the one who's really responsible for pushing workers hard. And I see workers, you know, running, literally, carrying buckets through the fields that I didn't see 30 years ago. I see other kinds of misconduct. We also have an important development in California, especially, that needs to be taken into account. And that is about 25% of the folks working in the fields today are indigenous migrants from southern Mexico, coming from villages where indigenous languages, Mixteco, Zapoteco, Trique, and other languages are spoken. And so the notion that somehow, because they are from Mexico, they are all Spanish-speaking, they are all of the same culture as the other folks who come from Mexico, is just incorrect. And what we find among the indigenous workers, and this is a report put out by Rick Mines and several of his colleagues recently, it's available on the web, called Indigenous Farm Workers, easy to find. They find that roughly one-third of indigenous farm workers are paid below the minimum wage in California today. And that's a measure of the kind of exploitation that goes on. And I think that is correct to have to focus on getting proper enforcement at the supervisory level. In fact, it was a supervisor in the case of Maria Isabel Jimenez who was unfortunately subjected to conditions where she did not properly access water and died of heat stroke after working in a field. And that was mentioned at the very outset by the gentleman from the farm worker background himself. So, you know, had there been proper supervision, in other words, a person as a supervisor coming to each of the workers and saying, you know, do you need some water today? Do you need to take a break? Do you need to sit under the shade? That kind of situation could have been avoided, and that's what we'd like to see.
All right, Dave, thanks very much for the call. Manuel Cunha, I've heard before the notion that it is the indigenous workers, the ones who don't speak Spanish, who are really at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of potential exploitation, even perhaps by their Spanish-speaking colleagues in the field. What are your thoughts about that? What do growers do to make sure that there's good communication with people who speak neither Spanish nor English?
Well, I disagree with some of Don's comments in that the one-third of the workforce doesn't get paid in California under the indigenous workers, because when I've seen as many as 75 inspectors hit this valley every month for a week and a half, when you find their reports and the Department of Labor also, you don't find the wage and hour violations at all, of wages not being paid when they collect the payrolls from the contractors and all that. So I disagree with that. But let's go to your question. Let me tell you, in 2007, the agriculture industry with OSHA sat down and said, what and how do we make training materials available for exactly that issue? The ag industry brought that up and worked with Len Welsh to develop the Mixteco-type languages for heat illness. The Southeast Asian community, all of this has been focused on the Hispanic community, the Latinos, but we also have Southeast Asians. We also have Southeast Indian, and we have developed and worked with OSHA to develop training materials in those languages. We did that with those agencies, whereas many of the advocacy groups have done nothing to do that. I mean, we talk about responsibilities of growers and employers of all industries, but also it's the responsibility of an employee to know that when they go home at night, not to just drink alcohol. They have got to eat the proper foods. And if you look at what agriculture did 3 years ago with Igloo Corporation out of Texas, we print, Igloo prints right on the big containers of water, the safety illnesses procedures in English and in Spanish. Agriculture came up with that idea. The company around this world that sends Igloo containers all over put that on their 10 and 5 gallon, even smallers. So to me, and we put up huge billboards on the freeways that shows the Hispanic, Latino, Asian person out there drinking water and taking their breaks. So all of those things, and let's go, Scott, 1 second to immigration.
Real quickly, because I do want to bring our listeners in.
Right. Comprehensive immigration will never happen in this country because of the volume, and the Congress won't deal with it, and they don't have the infrastructure. And that's why the UFW, Arturo Rodriguez, and agriculture have worked very hard for 9 years to get a bill called Ag Jobs that Senator Feinstein has. That is the opening of getting immigration done so we can peel off pieces of industries each year. So in 4 or 5 years, we've done 11 million people. But right now, agriculture is out there with its ag bill, working with Arturo. He's worked very hard on this to cooperate with agriculture and us with him. So,
and we should just say, for people who don't know, he's the president of the UFW.
I apologize. Sorry, Scott, the president. And we work and communicate, and we've worked closely on that issue. So for the listeners, we need to deal with the food chain of this country, and these workers need that type of legalization because right now Homeland Security is going to start, again this year, going out and raiding all of these businesses, which cause tremendous havoc in families.
Okay, let's go back to the phones now. Jennifer is on the line in Sacramento. Welcome.
Good morning. You know, I never want to eat anything or put lotion on my body that contains ingredients where someone died or wasn't paid to get it to me. I mean, for what? So I pay 70 cents for an apple instead of 90 cents? And I like the gentleman who was speaking before me who was talking about some progressive changes. I agree, we need to make changes little by little. But, you know, I intentionally shop at a grocery store that says where the food came from, and it's usually really close to Sacramento, and I can go out to the farm and see the farm.
And have you actually done that?
Yeah. Yeah, Full Belly Farm has a day, Soil Grain Farm.
Yeah.
And so I've gone out toward, you know, my husband speaks Spanish. We've spoken to people who work there.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is that I think businesses who, you know, these farms are want to make their greedy like everyone, and they want cheap labor, and they don't want to be responsible.
And Maisie Greenwald, consumers by and large want cheap food. I mean, we want produce that's affordable. What advice do you have for consumers? We just heard Jennifer saying she's very concerned about where the food comes from and how it's grown and picked and all that. But what advice do you have for people who may be interested but, you know, don't know what to do?
Well, Jennifer mentioned Full Belly Farms, and Judith Redmond, who is one of the founders and owners of Full Belly, told me once that one of the things that they do on their farm is every year they sit down with each worker and ask what that worker's goals are. And just that recognition of a worker as a human being with goals, with hopes, with aspirations is very meaningful. We spent a year talking to small farmers and workers on small farms. And the things that we heard that were the most meaningful was we got cookies during breaks. We had a family picnic. It's that recognition and respect of somebody as a person, and that doesn't cost anything.
Don Villarejo, any thoughts about what consumers can do, should do, or should think about as they're shopping?
Well, our organization, California Institute for Rural Studies, was founded on the following basic notion, and that is that we need an agricultural system that's socially just, ecologically sound, and economically viable. That is, protects workers, protects the environments, and protects the ability of farmers to earn a living. And we support that. And that can be done through support of farms like Full Belly Farms. But it's also the case that today, half of all food purchases in the United States are meals prepared away from home, whether it's in a restaurant, whether it's a fast food store, and so forth. So what we've seen over at least my lifetime is a decline of the proportion of food preparation that's done at the home that relies on farms like Full Belly. Instead, what we're seeing is a shift in another direction. So I think we need a much more comprehensive view about how people access food in this country and how that food is both prepared. And we need standards. I think standards with respect to protecting the environment, protecting workers, and making sure the farmer can earn a living. I find that once you explain to folks exactly what's going on in terms of our food system, that people are very receptive and very interested and think about what they can do and accordingly act more responsibly, as our previous caller, I believe it was Jennifer's name, mentioned. And I think that's a good thing, and we should support that.
All right, Jennifer, thank you for the call. Some breaking news right now from Sacramento. SB 104, the bill that would make it easier for farm workers to organize, has passed the Senate 24-14 party line vote. It now goes to the Assembly, where it is likely to pass as well, and then on to Governor Jerry Brown. Barry Bedwell, your reaction to that? We were talking earlier about it. What is agriculture going to do, the Farm Bureau and other groups representing growers in California with regard to this legislation?
Well, Scott, we're certainly going to continue our efforts to educate as many individuals as possible, particularly the governor, why we feel that this particular law as it is written is undemocratic, un-American, and really unfair to the farm employees themselves. When you look at that vote, that is entirely predictable. And, you know, even though we've talked to people on both sides of the aisle and we knew where they were going to vote, quite frankly, people that have put up an I vote today have expressed those concerns. We want to continue that dialogue to address the real issues here. If there is potential intimidation, why isn't the current law addressing it? How can we correct that? We're going to continue those efforts, and we think in the final analysis that Governor Brown, as one of the primary authors of this bill in 1975, will see the value of the secret ballot, and I think we'll come to a hopeful solution that will look entirely different than SB 104 does right now.
Don Villarejo, you also are a little skeptical about SB 104. How likely is it, do you think, that some of those changes you referred to will be made in the Assembly before it goes to the governor?
Well, as my philosophical hero, the former Yankee star Yogi Berra, once said, it's very hard to make predictions, especially about the future. And when it comes to legislatures, I'm even more skeptical. I do think that the bill could be improved. I'd like to see it improved and move in the directions that have been discussed by a couple of my colleagues on the program. I don't know whether that will happen or not, but I hope that it will.
We've got some email here. Let me read one from Keith in San Francisco, who writes, I can buy shade-grown organic woman-picked fair trade coffee, and I'm somewhat confident that the certification systems are legitimate. If I could buy my produce with a labor-safe or fair trade kind of certification, I'd gladly do it. Is there any NGO certification system for farm workers? Maisie Greenewald?
There's a group called the Domestic Fair Trade Association that has been discussing just that issue, and there are a number of fledgling projects, including the Agricultural Justice Project, for a fair trade, per se, label for domestic products. But today, there is not a widespread availability of that. Food Alliance out of the Northwest also has a labor component.
Barry Bedwell, would you be in favor of anything like that or trying to create some kind of a certification, just as there is, say, with organically grown food?
Well, currently there are efforts within the produce industry to work on a sustainability index. And exactly what Don described is really a program to recognize social responsibility, environmentally friendly to the environment, as well as being economically viable. There is a way to hopefully keep people aware and measure those inputs. Clearly, also within the supply chain, there are efforts to make sure, particularly the social responsibility aspects, are being followed. So, in the final analysis, it is always the consumer who is going to have the say here, and I think that's becoming clear. And as such, I think those of us involved with produce will clearly make a reaction to those requests.
Dov Urijo, we haven't talked a lot this hour about wages, but somebody earlier, I think it was maybe Barry Bedwell, mentioned that the rate is about $9 to $12 an hour for people working in the fields. I've heard lower daily pay as well. How big an issue is this? And do you think, you know, the issue often raised is, well, consumers aren't willing to pay more money for lettuce or grapes or whatever it might be if they were paid a higher wage. What are your thoughts about that, the pay structure?
Well, if you gave workers a 50% increase in picking strawberries, it would cost about 17.5 cents for a green basket of berries. And if you're paying, you know, $2 a basket these days, maybe you'd be willing to pay to 17 to see that workers got a decent and just wage. I don't think that it's fair to look simply at what the average wage rate is without realizing that most workers do not work year-round, do not work full-time. They are employed in a seasonal industry, and work ends when it ends. It ends when the crop is done and things are tightened up for the year. So you have to realize that the most important thing to look at is not simply wage rates, but annual earnings. And what are the annual earnings of farm workers? And they are pretty low, and they're about half in terms of just the wage rate differential between all other workers and farm workers. But if you take into account the fact that they work maybe two-thirds of the year, then you're really talking about one-third the annual earnings of the average American worker. And that is still unacceptable in my view.
All right. Well, thanks to all of you for being here this hour. Don Villarejo with the California Institute for Rural Studies, Maisie Greenewald from Bon Appetit Management, Barry Bedwell from the California Grape and Tree Fruit League. Thanks also to Manuel Cunha from the Nisei Farmers League, Eric Nicholson from the United Farm Workers, and earlier Juan Santiago from the Central Valley Youth Association, former farm worker himself. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Suki Lewis, Adam Hill, Douglas Ray, Vinnie Tong, and Julia James. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. I'm Scott Schaefer, here for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.